This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The Justice Department has launched a full-scale criminal investigation into whether current administration officials leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent to the media. President Bush says the White House will cooperate fully with the investigation, but Democrats on Capitol Hill say a special counsel should be appointed to look into the allegations. Last July, columnist Robert Novak, citing two senior administration officials, wrote that the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson was a CIA operative. His column came shortly after Wilson revealed that he had been sent to Niger to investigate whether Iraqi officials had secretly tried to buy uranium for nuclear weapons there. Wilson had reported there was no evidence to back that claim. Now he is charging that administration officials leaked the information about his wife in retaliation for his criticism of the administration's policy in Iraq. Investigations into such leaks get a huge amount of attention, dominating headlines and provoking passionate debate on Capitol Hill, but frequently they produce no conclusive answers. Today on Talk the Nation, we'll discuss leaks, how to investigate them, should it be the Justice Department or a special counsel, and what's the role of the media in such an investigation. Do you have a question as to what constitutes a leak, how leaks have been investigated in the past, and how this investigation will proceed? Do you want to know more about the role of a special counsel? Give us a call. Our number, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And you can reach us by email at totn@npr.org. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg. Nina, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Lynn.
To help us sort through all these complicated issues. Now, first of all, let's begin with the White House says it is supporting the Justice Department's investigation, but Democrats on the Hill are saying they think that this should be investigated by a special counsel. Why are the Democrats seeking a special counsel?
Well, because they don't trust the Justice Department, John Ashcroft's Justice Department, to investigate the very administration that is being investigated. And, you know, this is complete role reversal from Whitewater, for example. The party out of power doesn't usually like the party in power investigating itself. In this case, the Democrats are in an even more powerless position because they don't control either House of Congress. You can be sure that if they controlled either House of Congress, there'd be a congressional investigation. And they may yet figure out a way to at least broach the subject, you know, in a confirmation hearing, for example. There's no confirmed deputy attorney general right now. And when the administration names a deputy attorney general, that confirmation proceeding could become the lightning rod for a lot of questions.
Now, after Whitewater, didn't Congress do away with the whole idea of a special counsel or a special investigator?
It did. But let's go back for a second. The original Whitewater Independent Counsel was named at the urging, I should say, the pushed urging of President Clinton. At that point, the Independent Counsel law had expired, and there was no law requiring it. So finally, the heat got too much. The Clinton White House asked for the appointment of an Independent Counsel or a special counsel, and Janet Reno, after consulting with Republicans on Capitol Hill, picked Republican Robert Fisk. Later, he was replaced by Ken Starr when the law was reenacted. There have been, and then when it finally went out of business, so to speak, the Clinton administration put in effect regulations to provide for the appointment of a special counsel in circumstances where there were questions about whether an administration could investigate itself or the Department of Justice could investigate itself. And in 1999, I think it was, the Clinton administration named former Republican Senator John Danforth to investigate charges that there had been lying by the Justice Department and the FBI about Waco. And he investigated those charges and found that there hadn't been lying. But so it was already, that was the mechanism used. Way back in Watergate, Archibald Cox was, there was no independent counsel law. Just the heat got too much, and President Nixon named Archibald Cox, then didn't want to produce the famous tapes, fired him, and the heat got worse, and so he had to name somebody else, Leon Jaworski.
Yeah. So given the situation that exists right now politically in Washington, I mean, what are the chances that a special counsel would be named in this case?
I'm not a soothsayer, and I'm not sure we can say for sure. If history is any gauge, I think we'd have to say that the likelihood is that in the end there'll have to be some sort of special counsel, that these sort of things have a life of their own, and it just gets too difficult. Having said that, though, this story might not have legs. It might die. It might last a week or two and then be gone, and we've all seen that happen, too. So I don't think we can say for sure. What we can say is that as the investigation goes on, there'll be problems, certainly, for the Justice Department, the political appointees. They've given it now to the career people, and they say, you investigate it. But, for example, you can't bring reporters in front of a grand jury without the approval of the Attorney General or whoever is standing in for the Attorney General. Career officials simply can't do that under the rules and regulations of the Department of Justice. So those kinds of decisions have to be made by political appointees at some point, and it gets hairy.
And in this case, if a special counsel were to be appointed, wouldn't it be John Ashcroft who would be appointing that special counsel the way things are right now?
It would be John Ashcroft, absolutely. And the question would be, who would he appoint? Would he consult with Democrats? Would he, you know, in the Whitewater case, Republicans vetoed some choices, I think, that Janet Reno put to them and said, no, that's not acceptable. One person said to me, who's served in a lot of Justice Departments today, said, if Ashcroft gets to the point that he thinks he has to appoint a special counsel, there's no purpose served in him naming somebody who won't be believed. He has to pick somebody who will be believed, that he will have just compounded his problems. Of course, we're not there yet. We still have all kinds of questions, nasty questions. I mean, like, there are a lot of unappetizing choices here for investigators. Do they put reporters in front of a grand jury? That's usually the last thing you want to do. Mm-hmm. Do they, for example, want to do polygraphs of certain White House officials?
Yeah. And why is that the last resort, to put reporters in front of a grand jury? Why is that such an unpleasant prospect for?
Well, first of all, department regulations say it's the last resort. Secondly, most reporters in the end will not tell and will go to jail, and then you have a huge brouhaha in front of you. I can't recall a case, at least in the last few decades, maybe, I suppose you could go back to the Pentagon Papers. I can't recall a leak case that involved, quote, real national security problems. And certainly I can't recall one recently involving the disclosure of an undercover agent or a covert agent. So this may put a different tinge on it. Still, it's not a position any politician wants to be in, sending reporters off to jail to protect their sources. It's just extremely unappetizing.
Right, and a very well-known one in the case of Robert Novak as well. We're talking about leaks and how they're investigated, and the number, if you'd like to join our discussion, 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Anne, and she is in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wondered if your speaker could just address just a little bit more specifically, what is this law that was possibly broken? And in the case of what we keep hearing is Karl Rove was introduced to this as allegedly leaking it. Are there any more details that somebody like your speaker might have to tell us about?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Nina?
Let me take the last first. There are no more details. Mr. Wilson has in the past strongly suggested that it was Rove, that he was told by reporters that Rove or his minions were calling, trying to make this information public. He's quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Wilson is quoted in the Wall Street Journal today saying he may have gone a little overboard. So we don't know anything more than that, and there's certainly no concrete evidence
that Karl Rove,
did this. Your first question was what?
I think that the listener was asking a question I wanted to ask, which is maybe you can explain exactly what the law is. And doesn't the Justice Department have to first determine whether any law was broken here?
Well, you can't. It's hard. It's sometimes very difficult to do that until you know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
The law was passed at the specific request of George H.W. Bush when he was head of the CIA. Hmm. Who was outraged by the disclosure of the identity of at least one agent, one former agent, and or current agent, I really can't remember. And the law specifically says that disclosure of the identity of a covert agent is punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a fine of $50,000. Now, I don't have the statute in front of me. I'm sure there's some requirement of intent and knowledge that knowing that this was illegal or that improper or, and there's no way to know that until you find out who did it and what they knew and when they knew it and on whose instructions, if anybody's instructions, he or she did it. And it's a little bit like perjury, a little, in the Clinton case, in perjury. It's very difficult to prove perjury because you have to prove intent and there are great, very precise things you have to prove about perjury. That doesn't mean that somebody who tells what we all recognize as a lie doesn't take the rap for it politically, doesn't, and if this is a person in the White House, doesn't get fired at minimum, doesn't embarrass the administration at minimum.
Yeah, and I think in this case there's conflicting evidence or conflicting reports as to whether the officials in question. I think Robert Novak has said, well, nobody called me, nobody contacted me. This came out in the course of a conversation. There's other reports.
That's
that
what
say,
he says now.
Right.
Earlier he said, I didn't go after this story. It came to me. So he was quoted in Newsday as saying that. So those two accounts are, I suppose, reconcilable. You can imagine somebody calling up ostensibly with one purpose and managing to drop a little bomb while he or she is at it. These are all things you have to find out.
Let's see if we can take another call before you have to go, Nina. Kristen in Philadelphia. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question was basically about the accountability of, you know, the journalists who published that classified information, and just if they can be held accountable by law, but it sounds like a lot of that has already been answered.
Well, I should say we're going to be taking that question up in greater detail also after the break.
Okay.
when Nina has to go. But Nina, I wonder if you'd like to comment on that at all.
Generally, it's not news organizations that get prosecuted for this because they aren't the custodians of the classified information. They don't know per se what's what, and they publish classified information all the time, often at the behest of an administration. Sometimes information is declassified so that it can be released. Sometimes it's not. It's just let go as a trial balloon. And that's why prosecuting reporters or news organizations for publishing classified information becomes almost impossible, because every administration uses classified information and leaks classified information. This, however, is a very specific law that I think everybody can identify with more readily than questions about national security estimates and things like that. This involves a person who had a cover, and the law very specifically says you can't reveal that identity. I don't know what the law says about damage. Clearly, the CIA has made some sort of a damage assessment and has concluded that there wasn't enormous damage because they haven't gone to great lengths to prevent her name from being repeated.
And also, aren't there some questions as to whether she was a covert operative or an analyst? I've seen her reported as an analyst.
Lots of people in the CIA are undercover, even if they do analytical work. They may be working for an ostensibly private company and have all kinds of contacts. They may have a position in an embassy that's a chief of protocol that allows them to go out in the community and have lots of conversations. And there may be some people who understand that they aren't what they appear to be, but believe me, when the CIA wants to keep those identities secret, they go to great lengths to do it.
Thanks very much, NPR's Nina Totenberg. We'll continue this discussion when we return. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the investigation into who leaked the name of a CIA agent to the media. The identity and the motive of the leaker are unknown, except at least to one reporter who isn't talking. How will the investigation into the leak proceed? If you have questions, give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Many things are at stake in the investigation of a leak, among them the possibility that the leaker broke the law when he or she revealed the name of an undercover agent. The law that prevents the press from using the names of undercover agents hasn't been around for long. Joining us now to tell us about the origins of that law is Nick Coulter. He is a professor of history at Indiana University and the author most recently of Secret History, the CIA's Classified Account of Its Operations in Guatemala. He joins us by phone from Bloomington, Indiana. Thanks for being with us, Nick.
It's a pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about the origins of this law. Why was it thought to be necessary?
In the early 1970s, there were a series of revelations about the identities of CIA operatives, largely from disgruntled CIA agents themselves. Philip Agee wrote a book called Inside the Company, in which he actually had an appendix listing all of these operatives that he knew in Latin America. There were two magazines, one called Counter Spy, one called Covert Action Information Bulletin, that were staffed by former CIA agents. Victor Marchetti was one of them, that regularly carried features listing the names of CIA agents. The particular precipitating event was the assassination in Athens in Christmas of 1975 of Richard Welch, the CIA station chief in Athens. Now, it was alleged at the time that Welch was assassinated not because Counterspy had revealed his identity, but because everyone knew in Athens that the house that he lived in was the house of the CIA station chief. But nonetheless, the CIA director, George H.W. Bush, pressed Congress to pass legislation to outlaw the revelation of CIA identities. And then as vice president, George Bush took a personal interest in the legislation, coming into the Senate chamber at a critical moment to turn the tide in favor of the bill.
And so it actually became law when?
In 1982, June of 1982. I might say that it was a controversial bill when it was passed. The House passed it relatively easily with about 30 dissenting votes. But in the Senate, there were key figures, Joe Biden, Gary Hart, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who opposed it, largely because this bill would for the first time make it possible for someone to be prosecuted for publishing information that was already known to the public. And it was seen as a violation potentially of the First Amendment, or at least a modification of what we understood by free speech.
And we were talking just a little bit earlier with Nina Totenberg, and maybe you can clarify it a little bit further for us. What does this law say about intent? In other words, there's a question of questions are being raised here about the intention of the supposed administration officials who spoke to this reporter, whether it simply occurred in the course of a conversation, and then the second administration source supposedly said, "Oh, you know about this," as opposed to somebody actually making a phone call and making this leak very deliberately.
Mm-hmm. It leaves a lot to the Justice Department to decide about questions of intent and what should and should not be prosecuted. In 1991, for instance, Senator David Boren inadvertently released the name of a very high-ranking undercover operative of the CIA, accidentally listing him along with other people testifying before his committee in a public release. The Justice Department chose not to investigate and chose not to prosecute in that case. But there have been other cases where they have chose to investigate and to prosecute. Among other people, they've investigated they've investigated Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, for instance, while he was working on his book Veil.
But reporters, as I understand it, under this law, are actually, if the leak is made to a reporter, the reporter can make that public without being held accountable legally. Is that right?
In the Senate report, they indicated that there would be a distinction made for what they called legitimate journalists. And again, this caused a certain amount of uneasiness at the time because the federal government had not been in the habit of licensing journalists as legitimate or otherwise up to this point. It required some kind of a distinction to be made between a legitimate journalistic use and a non-legitimate. Now, what I can say is that the bill itself was intended to close down two journalistic organs, Covert Action Information Bulletin and Counterspy Magazine. And very shortly after it was passed, Covert Action Information Bulletin stopped publishing a regular feature that revealed the names of CIA operatives, and members of the Senate and the House expressed gratitude and relief that the bill had had the intended effect.
We have an email here, Nick, that I think a lot of people are wondering. And the question is, what is the difference between CIA operative, agent, officer, and covert analyst?
It's a good question, and I think it reveals a lot about this scandal. The CIA doesn't use the FBI terminology. Agent is really an FBI term. Their officers are classified as intelligence officers and as analysts. And agents is a term that within the CIA is used to refer to foreign nationals, typically, who are working not on for a CIA salary. So the term doesn't really apply in this case. Agent doesn't really apply. And the question of whether Ms. Plame was an analyst or not is in some sense irrelevant, because all CIA agents, all CIA personnel who travel abroad are encouraged to go undercover, simply because it's not safe for CIA personnel to advertise when they're overseas where they work for. And so a real question to ask here is whether Ms. Plame was overseas at the time that this occurred or not, and whether she had, in fact, taken a cover.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Nick.
Appreciate it.
Nick Hulather is a professor of history at Indiana University and the author, most recently, of Secret History, the CIA's Classified Account of Its Operations in Guatemala. He joined us from his office in Bloomington. The investigation into who disclosed the identity of a covert CIA agent raises several issues for journalists about revealing sources and writing stories that could compromise someone's safety. Tom Rosenstiel is a veteran journalist and media critic for both the Los Angeles Times and MSNBC. He now directs the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
My pleasure.
Tom, in a case like this where there's a possibility that a crime has occurred, should a journalist like Robert Novak reveal his sources?
No, actually. If you enter into a relationship, a confidential relationship with a source, even if that source has ill motives, and even if it was a mistake to run the story, which I think, as we can get into in a minute, this was, he's still under an obligation to protect that source. And I would say here, even it's been reported that several journalists were approached with this information and chose not to run stories about it. And I would argue that they also are bound by whatever confidentiality agreements they made with their sources, even if they never ran stories. And this, some people say, well, you know, don't you have an obligation as a citizen here? Well, how can you just play this journalist role? This is your obligation as a citizen, as a journalist, both. You are protecting the right of citizens to come to you and trust you. It's very much akin to the confidential relationship that a doctor has with a patient or a lawyer with a client. We depend on people being able to come to the press and be protected by the press, whether they're good guys or bad guys.
In the case of these other journalists who reportedly were approached by some administration official with this information, why couldn't they at least confirm that they had been approached? I mean, they wouldn't be revealing a source. They wouldn't have to say who approached them. They could just come forward and say, yes, in fact, it's true, somebody did approach us.
Well, and as I understand it, at least one journalist from NBC has come forward and denied that they were approached and said that this had only come up with the sources after the Novak column appeared. I don't think that it's clear-cut that you can't talk about whether people came to you, except you're taking a step down the road of beginning to sort of play this game, who were they, et cetera, et cetera. So there may be no gain in it. There may be no virtue in it, although you're not really actually violating anybody's confidentiality.
All right, let's see if we can take a call here. John in Bloomington, Indiana. Hi. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I guess Bloomington is a hotbed of Talk of the Nation listeners today. but I wanted to make a comment on how the story has been characterized in the last several days. I've heard it from several different media sources, and I have tended to hear it as you know, retribution or the reading of the intent behind these alleged actions as retribution against Wilson, which could be the case. But I think it's also important to consider the effect of silencing other potential critics out there, and could that not be the main intent and the Wilson intent being only incidental to that?
Tom?
Well, I mean, clearly there has been some punishment on the Wilson family. If indeed, as has been reported, his wife is a career CIA officer, that her career has been severely damaged. It seems to me that the damage here is more to her than necessarily to Wilson. But it's, if that's the case, then it's sort of like going after your family members instead of going after after you. And that has a chilling effect, clearly, on any potential person inside the administration or inside the government who might want to say something that is, off the reservation.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we move into the realm more of conjecture, because it's harder to measure those types of things, like who's not saying what out there. But that's partly my read, because it's consonant with other ways that the Bush administration has attempted to be much tighter in controlling information in many ways.
Well, that's certainly the reputation that the administration has had for 2 years. Most journalists in Washington would say that this administration has been unprecedented in its ability to control information and discourage leaking.
Let's just for a moment talk about the original story, Tom. Wouldn't a journalist have some ethical issues to resolve in running a story like that, in naming somebody who is, in fact, a CIA, an employee of the CIA, possibly a covert employee of the CIA?
Yes. Any time that a journalist runs up against breaking the law or getting close to some sort of legal transgression, generally you apply what I would call a civil disobedience test in making that decision. The first is what is the public good accomplished by telling the story? Second, is that public good outweigh the damage or harm you're committing by breaking whatever law, whether it's trespassing or in this case, revealing this information about this person? And the third test is there any other way to tell the story without committing this transgression? This story, it seems to me, fails on all three counts. The public good of this story is debatable. Some people don't see much at all. Certainly, however, it's overwhelmed by the potential harm, mortal harm, possibly, to the network of sources that a CIA operative might have overseas. And then thirdly, it fails on the last question. You could probably have told the story to discredit Wilson, if that's what you wanted to do, if that's what you thought was in the public interest, without even using the identity and name of this person. So this is really sort of a profoundly poor judgment on the part of the journalist, who, in a sense, by failing to meet this test, became simply an instrument of political revenge on the part of whoever his sources were.
If you'd like to join our discussion with Tom Rosensteel about media leaks, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tom, I don't know if you can answer this. You did just answer it in one way, but this email is specifically asking, what was Novak's journalistic justification for publishing this name? And has he given one?
Not clearly. He's said a couple of different things about this. One, that he didn't understand that she was a CIA operative and that the revelation of this information would be very devastating. He said that the CIA tried to dissuade him from using her name, but not very strongly, and that, as he understands it, she is merely an analyst. He's also suggested that at one point he wasn't, as your earlier guest pointed out, that he wasn't looking for this story, and that on other occasions he said that indicated that he was. So his explanations are murky and have actually added to the confusion. and he's given differing accounts in a column on television and in Newsday when he was quoted talking about this early on.
Well, let's see if we can get one more call in here. Chris, in Eugene, Oregon, go ahead.
Thank you. I wanted to ask who benefits from leaks? What are the benefits from leaks? I know, obviously, that the media has completely switched tracks here and is no longer covering, you know, the energy plan scandal or the scandal of the $87 billion. I mean, here in Oregon, we can't even feed our people. So who benefits from leaks?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Leaks are how administrations and governments and societies communicate to each other information that is dangerous or controversial. The first leak here involved Ambassador Wilson and his family. Now we have a second leak, which is someone else in the administration saying that this story was being peddled by people inside the Bush administration. So you have dissension in the administration over whether the first leak should have happened, and that's why this investigation now has been begun. It's because of a leak about a first leak. Many, many things have occurred of enormous public good from leaking, from the Pentagon Papers to Watergate to countless stories that you see in the paper every day. The fact is, for better or for worse, Washington journalism would grind to a halt without leaks. A leak, however, is a broad spectrum of things, and it's not necessarily someone calling you up out of the blue saying, Joe, I am about to leak to you. Very often it's Lynn picking up the phone, talking to somebody she talks to all the time, and the person leaks something out even without realizing it. You put two and two together, and you're on to another story.
One last question. How do journalists decide whether or not to trust a leak?
Well, that's...
I mean, how do they know when it's not being planted?
Right.
This may have been in the...
That's also a really important and subtle question, because just because you are being used by a source doesn't mean that that story is not in the public interest and that it might not be worth telling, even though you are serving the purposes of somebody in an administration. The journalist has to decide, A, what is the public value of this information? B, what axe does the source have to grind, and how direct is their information? How accurate is their information? And then C, we have a responsibility, which we often don't meet, of then sharing as much of that with the reader or the viewer as we can.
Thanks so much, Tom Rosenstiel, journalist and media critic for the LA Times and MSNBC. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.